There were many arbitrary provisions, such as the exemptions for the town of Collioure, for some but not all religious institutions, some officers, some magistrates, some people of note. The Gabelle, like France, was established piecemeal. The first attempt at a comprehensive salt administration occurred in the Bear Salt Works near Marseille in 1259 by St. Louis's brother, Comte Charles de Provence. The following century, this administration was extended to Pequet, Aigues-Mortes, and the Camargue, an area that became known administratively as the Pays de Petite Gabelle. In 1341, Philip VI established a salt administration in northern France that was labeled the Pays de Grande Gabelle. At the time, these two areas included most of the territory controlled by the French crown. At first, the Gabelle imposed a modest 1.66% sales tax on salt. But each monarch eventually found himself in a crisis. A prince to be ransomed, a war to be declared, that was resolved by an increase in the salt tax. By 1660, King Louis XIV regarded the Gabelle as a leading source of state revenues. One of the Gabelle's most irritating inventions was the sel de devoir, the salt duty. Every person in the Grande Gabelle over the age of 8 was required to purchase 7 kilograms, 15.4 pounds of salt each year at a fixed high government price. This was far more salt than could possibly be used unless it was for making salt fish, sausages, hams, and other salt-cured goods. But using the sel de devoir to make salted products was illegal, and if caught, the perpetrator would be charged with the crime of faux saunage, salt fraud, which carried severe penalties. Many simple acts were grounds for a charge of faux saunage. In the Camargue, shepherds who let their flocks drink the salty pond water could be charged with avoiding the Gabelle. A 1670 revision of the criminal code found yet another use for salt in France. To enforce the law against suicide, it was ordered that the bodies of people who took their own lives be salted, brought before a judge, and sentenced to public display. Nor could the accused escape their day in court by dying in the often miserable conditions of the prisons. They too would be salted and put on trial. Breton historians have discovered that in 1784, in the town of Cornouailles, Maurice Lecor had died in prison and was ordered salted for trial. But due to some bureaucratic error, the corpse did not get a trial date and was found by a prison guard more than 7 years later, not only salted, but fermented in beer, at which point it was buried without trial. Louis XIV put the state's finance and commerce in the hands of Jean-Baptiste Colbert, the son of a merchant family from the Champagne region. Colbert was a leading advocate of the school of economics known as mercantilism, which held that the value of the state was measured in the goods it exported and the precious metals it imported. To this end, both production and trade were to be tightly controlled by the state through such tools as taxes and tariffs. Mercantilism held that the sum total of world trade was limited, so that if England increased its trade, it would be at the expense of France and everyone else. In salt, Colbert reasoned, France had a valuable export product. He was directly involved in marketing French salt to the Nordic countries, and he made important improvements in French waterways to move salt more efficiently. He believed that France made the world's best salt, which is not a surprising point of view for a Frenchman, but many Englishmen, Dutch, and Germans of the time agreed. Colbert corresponded with salt makers about technical improvements. Today in Guérande, it is proudly asserted that Louis XIV would only eat Guérande salt. If this is true, it would explain why he was so interested in improving the color. Colbert pointed out that if it were white like the salt of France's primary salt competitors, Spain and Portugal, it would sell better. But the paludiers of Guérande continued to rake up salt with green algae and the charcoal-colored clay mud on which the ponds were built. Colbert's name became infamous in French salt history when, in 1680, he revised the Gabelle, codifying the inequities among regions into 6 unequal zones. The Pays de Grand Gabelle was the oldest part, the heart of France, including the Paris region. With only 1/3 of the French population, who used only 1/4 of the French salt, and yet who paid 2/3 of the state's salt revenue, the residents of this region were the angriest people in France. Local merchants imported inexpensive salt from Portugal, the white salt of Setúbal, to try to lower the local price. The Pays de Petite Gabelle on the Mediterranean, where much of the salt production was owned by the crown, was less rigidly controlled, but also so heavily taxed that 1/4 of all salt tax revenue was squeezed from this 1/5 of the population. In the third region, the Pays de Salines, which included Lorraine and other areas of inland brine wells, the crown also owned much of the production. But in this region, unlike the Grande and Petite Gabelles, both wholesale and retail sales were carried out by private merchants rather than agents of the state. Hence, far less political tension existed in this region, but far less revenue was earned by the crown. People in the Pays de Salines consumed twice as much salt as those in the Grande Gabelle. Adam Smith would no doubt have argued that the relative free trade of the Pays de Salines increased sales, though it could also be argued that the northern French did not traditionally eat as much salted food as in eastern France, with its ham, sausage, and choucroute. In southwestern France, François I, the 16th-century monarch who kept his table salt in a salini, dropped the small but irritating consumer tax and replaced it with a much larger tax on producers. After a year of angry protests, he cut this tax in half, and a year later, in 1543, the tax was entirely dropped. Instead, the rigid administration of the Grande Gabelle, with its controls on production, wholesale operations, and retail sales, was to be extended to this region. The result was a movement of some 40,000 farmers who rose up in armed rebellion with the slogan, Vive le roi sans Gabelle. Long live the king without the Gabelle. The French crown, shocked by the size and ferocity of the uprising, backed down, thankful that at least they were still saying Vive le roi. It was decided that in this troubled region, known to the Gabelle as Pays Redimé, would be prudent for the crown to content itself with only the revenue from tolls on the transport of salt. When Colbert codified the Gabelle, he kept this southwestern Pays Redimé with its exemptions, which meant that while the north endured severe salt controls, and the east and the Mediterranean also had some, untaxed southwestern salt could be traded across the region's southern border into Spain at competitive prices. Worse, the Basque provinces, which were right on the Spanish border as a condition of their participation in France, were exempted from the Gabelle, leaving the Basques in an ideal position to trade inexpensive salt in both countries. Added to the Gabelle's complicated multi-tiered system was yet another privileged border region, a small area on the English Channel where salt makers boiled seawater with the ashes of seaweed, making a fine white salt similar to peat salt. The crown had pleased this region with only light salt taxes, but then realizing that such high-quality, inexpensive salt could easily flood the neighboring Grande Gabelle, restricted the amount of salt produced by limiting the number of salt works. To the rest of France, the most irritatingly unequal region was the Pays Exempt, made up of Brittany and newly acquired areas in the north, such as Flanders, which had been brought into France with the promise that they would not have to participate in the Gabelle. These were also fishing regions like Collioure, and Colbert wanted fishing areas to be exempt from the salt tax. He had a great belief in the value not only of salt fish as an export, but of fishermen as a potential navy. The Pays Exempt also included the entire salt-producing coast from Guérande to the salt-making islands off La Rochelle. In the mid-18th century, salt provided work for 950 families in the Gironde region alone. About 500 men were paludiers, working 32,000 salt ponds. More than 3,000 ponds had been added since the 16th century. The Gabelle had made paludiers an agricultural elite, earning a better living than most peasants of the time. Some even owned small parts of their salt works. Brittany, like Basque country, was a border region with cheap, untaxed salt to trade. In this case, across the channel to England and up the coast to Holland. In the 17th century, so many English, Welsh, Scottish, and Dutch ships put into Le Croisic for salt that the local Catholic Church worried about a Protestant influence on the townspeople. In 1784, the French government turned to Jacques Necker, a Swiss banker so brilliant in his administration of the disastrous French economy that for a moment it appeared he would save the monarchy. In 1784, he reported that a minot of salt, which was 49 kilograms, 107.8 pounds, cost only 31 sous in Brittany, but 81 in Poitou, 591 in Anjou, and 611 in Berry. Necker recognized that with such price differences, France was rich in opportunities for smugglers. Salt smugglers and clandestine salt makers, the faux-saunières, were simply opportunists amassing illegal fortunes, underselling legal salt. Yet they became popular heroes who could wander the countryside helping themselves to farm products without ever hearing a complaint from a peasant. Colbert's 1680 revision of the Gabelle made it a crime for an innkeeper to give a room to a salt smuggler. A repeat offender could be sentenced to death. The Gabelous, the hated collectors and enforcers of the Gabelle, were often crude and lawless men, abusive of their special privileges, which included carrying arms and stopping, questioning, searching, or arresting people at will. The Gabelous were especially distrustful of women and abusive to them, sometimes squeezing a choice part for the pleasure of it. Often, to their disappointment, they would find bags of salt in these places. Women hid salt in their breasts, corsets, posteriors, places where they hoped not to be squeezed. Sometimes entire faux culs, false rears, would be constructed for hiding salt in a dress. Something close to a state of permanent warfare developed between salt smugglers and the Gabelous. Gabelous would be murdered, and the crown would respond by having royal troops sack the village where the crime took place. On September 8, 1710, the Gabelous went heavily armed into the woods near Avignon to intercept salt smugglers, and 40 or 50 salt traders opened fire on them. The area was in open rebellion. Similar rebellions were breaking out all over France. The most important smuggling border in France was the Loire River, which marked the line between the Pays Exempt and the Pays de Grande Gabelle, between Brittany and Anjou, regions where Necker had found the price of salt to be 31 sous and 591 sous, respectively. In 1698, a government official reported that salt smuggling is endless on the Loire. Normally impoverished peasants living along the river could earn comfortable incomes from moving salt. The legendary smugglers had colorful pseudonyms, such as François Gantier, a.k.a. Potolet, Milk Pitcher. Because local fishermen, who knew all the hidden islands and coves of the river, would carry salt, the crown declared it illegal to fish at night. By 1773, the Gabelle had 3,000 troops stationed on the Loire to stop salt smuggling. Some ruses were complicated. Salt cod that landed at Le Croisic was moved up the Loire for sale in France. Some of the cod had been salted and dried on land, but another product, known as green salt cod, not because of its color but because it was closer to its natural state, was made on board ship, where it was only salted but not dried. This was a more delicate cure and required ample salt to prevent spoilage while in transit. But at times, it seemed to inspectors, the fish was considerably oversalted. Cod would be shipped in thick layers of salt. Salt inspectors on the Loire would examine the cod shipments from L'Équassic, entering the Pays de Grande Gabelle, fish by fish, shaking off the excess salt, making note of how much salt fell off of how many fish. If too much salt fell off, it would be reported. However, merchants found that their journey could be expedited by the gift of a few salt cod to the right official. By the late 18th century, more than 3,000 French men, women, and even children were sentenced to prison or death every year for crimes against the Gabelle. The salt law in France, as would later happen in India, was not the singular cause of revolution, but it became a symbol for all the injustices of government. In 1789, the French revolted, declaring the establishment of a national assembly. When King Louis XVI tried to send troops against this revolutionary legislature, a mob attacked the Bastille, and an armed revolution began. That same year, the revolutionary legislature repealed the Gabelle. Some in the assembly had argued for a low salt tax universally applied, but in the end, the assembly voted for no salt tax at all, not even bothering to replace this mainstay of state revenues with another source of income. On March 22, 1790, the National Assembly, calling the salt tax odious, annulled all trials for violation of the Gabelle and ordered all those charged, on trial, or convicted to be set free. Louis, accused of conspiring with Austrians and Prussians to overthrow the revolution, was beheaded. His wife, Marie Antoinette, who loved choucroute, was also beheaded, as were many of the Swiss soldiers of the Garde Royale. They also had acquired the court taste for choucroute, and numerous inns had sprung up near the Palais Royal, where they had spent their meal breaks, feasting on choucroute with sausages and salted meats. The tradition of restaurants serving midday choucroute in that part of Paris continues to this day. In 1804, Napoleon Bonaparte, who had risen to head of the revolutionary army and then rose to first consul, became emperor of the French. He reinstated the Gabelle, but without an exemption for Brittany. Their salt no longer having a competitive advantage, the paludiers, instead of being slightly better off than the average French peasant, were now among the poorest. They continued to wear large, floppy, three-cornered hats in the style of 18th-century peasants. Visitors found this a picturesque part of Brittany. Novelist Honoré de Balzac abandoned poetic restraint in his description of the paludiers and their treeless salt marsh, writing that they had the grace of a bouquet of violets, and asserting that it was something a traveler could see nowhere else in France. He compared the area to Africa, and in the age of French colonialism, many followed, comparing the impoverished Breton paludiers to Tuaregs, Arabs, and Asians. Faced with an onslaught of affluent French who found them exotic, the paludiers made souvenirs. Ceramic plates depicting their dress and dolls in paludier costume, fashioned out of seashells. Le Bourg de Batz became Batz-sur-Mer, Batz by the sea, to make this salt town by the swamp sound more suitable for tourism. The salt cuisine of Brittany showed its poverty. Breton cooking was based on the few simple crops that paludiers could grow in their clay-bound soil, mostly potatoes and onions, which absorbed a salty taste from the seaweed in the soil. Ragout de Bernique, literally a stew made of nothing, was in fact made of potatoes, carrots, and onions. While France was one of the last European nations to accept the eating of potatoes, Brittany was one of the first potato-eating parts of France. Almost 40 years earlier, Antoine Augustin Parmentier had persuaded the royal family to promote the eating of potatoes, and a man named Blanchet launched a potato-eating campaign in Brittany. Soon after that, a cleric named de la Marche distributed potatoes to poor parishioners and was nicknamed Descap à la Patates, the potato bishop. After the revolution, Paludiers supplemented their diminished income by growing potatoes, which were boiled in brine that left a fine salt powder on the skin. Patat cuiocel. A Breton expression was, Kement al zofal agar arsal. Everything that is not good asks to be salted. Everything from meat to butter to potatoes was salted. Salt was Brittany's cheapest product, the one everyone could afford. Another Breton proverb was, Avis hag holen aror dan nep a kohalen. Advice and salt are available to anyone who wants it. Kig sal, salted pig, usually was made with the ears, tail, and feet. Sometimes better cuts, if they could be afforded, put in a barrel with lard and salt, and kept 2 or 3 months until preserved like ham. And there was oing, known in Breton as bloneg, which was nothing more than pork fat rendered with salt and pepper, dried in the open air on paper, and then smoked in a fireplace. A slice of oing was added to a vegetable soup as a substitute for meat. In the 1870s, when the area was connected to the national railway system, the floppy, three-cornered hats vanished. The same railroad system favored eastern France, where the new industries such as steel were, and made the salt of Lorraine more accessible than sea salt. The Gabelle remained a part of French administration until it was finally abolished in the newly liberated France of 1946. Honoré Gabriel Riquetti, the Comte de Mirabeau, the man who had defied Louis XVI by opening the National Assembly, said, "In the final analysis, the people will judge the revolution by this fact alone. Does it take more or less money? Are they better off? Do they have more work? And is that work better paid?" Chapter 15. Preserving Independence. Treaties are usually imperfect solutions, and the Treaty of Paris did not end all hostilities between the new United States and Britain. The United States was embargoed from any British goods, and British colonies were not permitted to engage in U.S. trade. The Turk Islands, the present-day Turks and Caicos, including Salt Key, became havens for Americans still loyal to Britain. In Cape Cod, the price of salt rose from 50 cents a bushel to $8. In 1793, in a post-war economy that was still demanding salt, another Sears, Reuben Sears, a Cape Cod carpenter, invented a roof that slid open and shut on oak rollers, allowing sea salt to now be made efficiently from March until November. The vats were exposed while the sun was shining, but after sunset and whenever it began to rain, the roofs were rolled over the vats. Though the salt works were privately owned, the Cape Cod communities considered them so essential to the general well-being that when clouds began to darken the daytime sky, men and women would run out to roll all the roofs closed, and children would be sent from the schools to help, and the coastline would rumble like nearby thunder from the sound of hundreds of oak wheels. The small-scale Yankee entrepreneur for whom New England was famous found an opportunity in salt. By 1800, a small initial investment in a Cape Cod saltworks would quickly yield returns of 30%. Most of the stretches of virgin sand beach and upland dunes, land considered useless until then, were becoming marred with windmills, pipes, and huge vats with rolling roofs. The prices were high and the market seemed endless. Whatever salt was not used by local fishermen was shipped to Boston or New York. As long as the profits were copious and easy, Cape Codders cared no more about their spoiled dunes than did the people in Cheshire worry about their blackened skies. On Cape Cod they talked of the lazy man's gold mine, and it seemed everybody wanted to get into salt making. The glassworks in Sandwich, famous in the 19th century for their little glass salt cellars, needed intense heat for glassmaking. The cooling fires still gave off enough heat to evaporate seawater, and salt became a byproduct of their glassmaking. With an increased salt supply, the fishing industry grew. The Americans did not forget the salt shortages of the Revolution. Several states, including Massachusetts, still paid bounties to salt producers. The new nation remained in principle determined to encourage salt production. In practice, this was not always the case. When the new government realized that there was an unregulated commerce in whiskey in western Pennsylvania, traded across the Allegheny for salt, it responded by taxing the whiskey in order to stop the trade. In 1791, the whiskey-producing farmers rebelled, and beloved President Washington shocked the public by calling out a militia to put down what has become known as the Whiskey Rebellion. In 1787, the new Americans began producing salt in Onondaga, New York. Jesuit missionaries who had been with the Onondaga tribe in the 17th century first told Europeans of the salt springs there. One French missionary, Father Simon Lemoyne, wrote in his diary, "We tasted a spring which the Indians dared not drink. They say it is inhabited by a demon who makes it fetid. I found it was a salt spring. In fact, we made salt as good as sea salt and carried a quantity of it to Quebec." The Onondaga are an Iroquois-speaking tribe, hosts to the annual meeting of the Iroquois. Like some, but not all, of the Iroquois groups, they had sided with the British during the Revolution. In 1788, New York State negotiated a treaty with the Onondaga, establishing a 10,000-acre reservation with joint ownership. But in 1795, the treaty was renegotiated, and the Onondaga, a people that traditionally had not even used salt, gave up their rights to the land in exchange for the annual delivery to the Onondaga Nation of 150 bushels of salt. In 1787, when the whites began producing salt there, it had been at a rate of only 10 bushels a day. The state is still delivering its annual salt payments, though some Onondaga now feel that they would rather have the land returned. The payments amount to a truckload of 5-pound bags, which the state buys for the best price it can find, usually between $1,000 and $2,000, which is not a huge increase from the $900 that 150 bushels of salt cost at the time. Today the Onondaga use much of their salt for preserving deer and other game and making a great deal of sauerkraut, neither of which was a tradition before contact with Europeans. According to Audrey Shenandoah, a member of the Onondaga, "We make a lot of sauerkraut, that is, since the contact. We grow a lot of garden vegetables, a lot of cabbage, and make sauerkraut. But we didn't use salt for much but medicine before the contact." Salt is still used by the Onondaga to draw out the infection from an insect bite or the prick of a thorn. In 1797, the state of New York began granting leases for working the brine springs of Onondaga. The state fixed a maximum price of 60 cents per bushel, with a 4 cents per bushel tax. That year, production at the springs, centered in the town of Salina, was 25,500 bushels. But by 1810, Onondaga and Cayuga counties were producing about 3 million bushels annually, using both solar and wood-fired evaporation. The brine springs had become the most important salt works in the new United States. The feeling was strong in the United States that the British were not to be trusted. They had never withdrawn, as promised, from U.S. territory along the Great Lakes. They encouraged the hostility toward the United States of Native Americans, including the Onondaga and Cayuga, and they refused any agreement that would be in any way helpful to the U.S. economy. John Jay's 1795 treaty with Britain, which opened trade but on terms more favorable to England than the United States, was unpopular. The British claimed the right to force into their own service any British sailor serving on a U.S. ship and boarded American merchant vessels in search of them. They frequently also took American sailors. In 1807, a British warship fired on the American frigate Chesapeake. President Thomas Jefferson responded with the Embargo Act, banning U.S. ships from foreign trade. This act was aimed at both the British and the French because both boarded American merchant vessels. Not only did the trade ban fail to change European policy, but it was an economic disaster for New England. The embargo was dropped, but there were calls for a retaliatory invasion of the remaining British colonies in North America, present-day Canada. In a young country in which the North and South were increasingly at odds with each other, the cry for such radical measures against Canada usually came from Southerners. New Yorkers simply complained that Canada was able to attract the larger share of upstate commerce because it had better commercial waterways. In 1808, a resolution recommending consideration of a canal connecting the Great Lakes to the Hudson River was introduced in the New York Assembly by Joshua Foreman from the salt-producing town of Salina. Foreman believed that the canal was the necessary key to expanding the salt industry. It would offer the Onondaga salt region an inexpensive route for bulk shipment to New York City. From there, the world would be their market. Despite considerable opposition to the proposal, $600 was appropriated to survey a possible route. Politicians and financiers in New York were distrustful of the project, fearing it would undermine the importance of the Port of New York. The exception was the former mayor of New York City and current governor, DeWitt Clinton. The leading advocate of the canal, Governor Clinton was from one of the most prominent New York families. His father James had been a Revolutionary War hero, and his uncle George served as vice president from 1805 to 1812 under both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. But both of these presidents expressed their doubts about the project. Governor Clinton appointed James Geddes to make the survey. Geddes, who lived in Onondaga County, was a lawyer, a judge, a former state legislator, and an amateur surveyor. The salt-producing town of Geddes was named after him, and he had been one of the pioneers of the local salt industry, the industry that needed the canal. He spent most of 1808 traveling between the Hudson River and Lake Erie, examining the topography. In 1809, a New York delegation went to Jefferson, hoping to persuade him to consign federal funding for the project. The moment seemed auspicious. For the first time in the short history of the United States, the nation was solvent, had settled its huge debt, and revenue was expanding. But Jefferson said, "It is a splendid project and may be executed a century hence," and concluded, "It is little short of madness to think of it at this time." Clinton then went looking for New York State funding for the project that was increasingly known as Clinton's Ditch. In 1810, the New York State Legislature approved a board of commissioners with a $3,000 budget to investigate the feasibility of constructing a commercial canal connecting Lake Erie and the Hudson River. If this could be done, the United States would have a waterway from New York City to what is now the Midwest, but was then thought of as the Western frontier. The public regarded this commission as a scam, a summer vacation at taxpayers' expense to upstate New York, an area viewed in New York City as a scenic vacation ground. This suspicion was reinforced by the revelation that a number of the commissioners were planning to take their wives. The commission was losing support and probably would have been canceled had it not been for a completely unrelated concern about a mud bar. The legislature assigned the Canal Commission to investigate the mud bar, which was of far greater public concern than the possible canal. DeWitt Clinton took part in the 1810 commission, which reported that the salt works were producing far below their capacity, but were limited by poor roads. Exploring alternatives, they asked locals what they felt would be the result if they built a good road from the salt works to Lake Erie, only 9 miles away. Locals gave Clinton his ideal response by agreeing that such a road would only profit the British. Canadian schooners on Lake Erie would pick up the salt and sell it in British North America. The final argument for the canal was the inevitable war with Britain from 1812 to 1815. When this war broke out, the Americans were faced once again with a salt shortage. The British blockaded Massachusetts and tried to prevent Cape Cod salt from reaching Boston or New York, The wily New England sailors sometimes slipped through at night. In December 1814, the British landed a warship in Rock Harbor on the bay side of Orleans, Cape Cod, and threatened to burn down the local salt works. The summer before, the British had gotten to Washington, D.C., and burned most of the public buildings, including the presidential residence, forcing President Madison to flee. So no one in Orleans doubted the British resolve to burn their little windmill and rolling roof saltworks. A Cape Cod militia was waiting on the beach when the British attempted to land and reportedly shot and killed two British sailors in a brief skirmish that forced the British to withdraw. A month later, Andrew Jackson won the final battle, the Battle of New Orleans, in which 2,000 British soldiers died, and Cape Codders could not resist calling their own brief engagement over their saltworks the Battle of Orleans. As soon as the war ended, lawmakers pushed to approve the Erie Canal, and work began in 1817. The estimated cost of the project was $6 million, almost $5 per inhabitant of New York State. Among the state's plans to finance the completion of the canal was to tax upstate salt at a rate of 12.5 cents per bushel. It was one of the few salt taxes in history that was not resented. The canal would bring prosperity to the salt region. The canal was built in sections, and each was put into service upon its completion. The first section to be completed was the 98 miles from Utica to the Seneca River, the section that ran through the salt-producing region. A way station to assess barge loads, designed to look like a Grecian waterside temple, was built in the tiny, backwoods stopover of Syracuse. In October 1825, the last section of the canal was completed, and Governor Clinton and other notables went to Buffalo to board the boats of a flotilla making the inaugural voyage to New York City. The lead vessel was the Seneca Chief, which carried a portrait of Clinton in Roman toga by a distinguished lithographer of the day. Among the notables joining Clinton on board was Joshua Foreman. The vessel was provisioned with symbolic items, including two kegs of Lake Erie water to be poured into the Atlantic off Sandy Hook, some whitefish, a canoe made by Lake Superior tribesmen, and potash from the saltworks. The Erie Canal was 363 miles long. Like most famous bridges and waterways, it occasionally attracted unhappy romantics wishing to leap to their death. But when they hit Clinton's Ditch, they were shocked to discover that, with limited funding, the state had only been able to afford to dig the canal 4 feet deep. The canal had opened at a prosperous time for American salt. In 1837, Cape Cod alone had 658 salt companies producing more than 26,000 tons per year. But Cape Cod lost its competitive advantage once upstate New York had its own waterway to New York City. Not only did the New Yorkers now have more efficient transportation, but borrowing Cape Cod ideas, they also made their salt more efficiently. The salt springs are in the towns of Liverpool, Salina, and Syracuse in the county of Onondaga. The works which we had an opportunity of examining in Syracuse are constructed upon the plan of the works upon the Cape and on our own coasts and beaches. Open and extensive vats, covered at night and during the rainy and wet weather. But evaporation is hastened by boiling the water in large kettles constructed on purpose in Liverpool and Salina. Wood is abundant and so cheap that the expense is very trifling. The water is drawn up by horse and steam power, and it is estimated that 90 gallons of water will make one bushel of salt, so perfectly is the water saturated with salt. Barnstable Patriot, September 4th, 1830. The New York salt works used Cape Cod-style rolling roofs. Apparently something about these roofs was great fun. In both Cape Cod and Syracuse, families were constantly complaining about their young sons slipping away to the salt works and wearing out their pants, sliding down the roofs and crawling between the vats. Childhood memoirs contain detailed descriptions of the salt works as playgrounds with acres of vats dripping stalactites of white, amber, and rust red. As the New York salt works prospered, with salt vats taking up more and more acres, it became more difficult to roll back all the roofs in the face of a sudden downpour. Watchtowers were built with warning bells. If the rain watchers saw dark clouds, they rang the bells, and hundreds of workmen and their families immediately ran to push the covers over the vats. The workers lived in villages close around the salt works, so they could be near the vats when the bells rang. The entire families ran to the salt works, competing with each other to be first to cover a complete row. Winning families got small cash prizes. Many of the New York salt workers were Irish. The Irish soaked both potatoes and corn in brine. Salt potatoes, new potatoes cooked in brine much the same as were made by the salt workers in Guérande, are still a specialty of Syracuse. Salina was an important center with hundreds of salt works and several hundred homes. Syracuse, chosen as the best route for canals, had been an undeveloped, swampy lowland. Colonel William L. Stone, passing through in 1820 when the Syracuse population was 250 people, wrote, "It is so desolate it would make an owl weep to fly over it." The Erie Canal ran west to east, and the Oswego Canal, which connected the Erie Canal to Lake Ontario, ran north to south. The two intersected in the center of the town of Syracuse. With its torch-lit bridges over reflecting canals, Syracuse became known as the American Venice. Once Syracuse became Venice, Salina was reduced to a suburb. Syracuse was now, like the Italian Venice, a salt port, where Onondaga salt was loaded onto Erie Canal barges. By the time the full canal was opened, only 5 years after the town was said to sadden stray owls, Syracuse had tripled its population, and by 1850, 22,000 people lived there. Not only did New York have a Venice, it had a Liverpool, the town being named so that Onondaga salt could be shipped around the United States with that trusted old brand name, Liverpool Salt. After the American Revolution, a debate had begun about where to locate the capital of the new country. Virginians, arguing for the Potomac, made the outlandish claim that this Virginia River, which empties into Chesapeake Bay, also connected with the Ohio. This would have made the Potomac America's central waterway, since the Ohio cuts through the Midwest and enters the Mississippi. It was a Virginia propaganda ploy, and no such river connecting the Mid-Atlantic to the Mississippi exists. However, Virginia did have a river that, while it never reaches the Atlantic, connected Virginia to the Ohio River. In the western part of the state, today West Virginia, the Great Kanawha River begins and flows into the Ohio, carrying goods and people to Cincinnati and Louisville. As Americans moved west across the Appalachians, this was one of the major routes. The river trade and migration turned the frontier town of Charleston, West Virginia, into a trading center. Pivotal to this trade, and even more pivotal to the economic development of the Midwest, was a 10-mile stretch of the Kanawha that produced salt. On the northern bank of the Great Kanawha was a huge salt lick known as the Great Buffalo Lick. The first Europeans in the area noted indigenous people making salt at the lick and also noted the many wide trails made by buffalo and deer to this place. In fact, it was animals, not so-called trailblazers such as Daniel Boone, that had carved the original trail across the Allegheny Mountains to the Ohio River Valley. In 1769, when Daniel Boone followed that trail, crossing the Cumberland Gap into Kentucky, he took with him Kanawha salt, as did the thousands of other settlers that followed. In 1797, a man named Elisha Brooks leased land on the lick and sank the hollowed trunks of 3 sycamore trees 10 feet into the ground. The 3 pipes served as wells. Using 24 kettles to evaporate the brine by burning almost 5 cords of wood, Brooks produced 3 bushels in a day. A decade later, the Ruffners, a family of inventive salt prospectors, made a new kind of drill by fitting an iron rod into a tapered wooden tube. A heavy wooden block was repeatedly raised and dropped on the rod, driving it into the ground, with the tube as a guide. But after 17 feet, having reached solid rock, the rod would go no deeper. They then tried fitting a metal chisel to the rod, and the repeated pounding into the rock below slowly drilled a hole. This was considered a great innovation in drilling at the time, although the Sichuan Chinese had been doing the same thing since the 12th century. In 1807, the Kanawha salt makers even invented a tube with a valve on the bottom to extract brine in the same way the Chinese had been doing it for 700 years. By 1809, with these new inventions, Kanawha was experiencing a boom. Some 50 Kanawha salt producers had made their small riverfront the most important salt region in the United States after the Onondaga region. New holes were being drilled and new boiling houses were being built. Most of the salt producers at Kanawha were short-term, small-scale operators who saw an opportunity to become wealthy in only a few years. In 1815, when 55 furnaces were operating, the largest producer had 4. Most were single furnace operations burning local coal. The War of 1812 created the Kanawha Salt Works' best years. With no Liverpool salt and shortages everywhere, the number of furnaces increased in the 3 years of war from 16 to 52. When you merely want to corn meat, you have nothing to do but to rub in salt plentifully and let it set in the cellar a day or two. The navel end of the brisket is one of the best pieces for corning. A 6-pound piece of corned beef should boil 3 full hours. Put it in to boil when the water is cold. If you boil it in a small pot, it is well to change the water when it has boiled 1.5 hours. The fresh water should boil before the half-cooked meat is put in again. Lydia Maria Child, The American Frugal Housewife, 1829. The great opportunity for Kanawha salt came with the post-war Midwestern pork and beef industries. Because Kanawha salt could move inexpensively down the Ohio River, Midwestern farmers produced tremendous quantities of pigs and cattle, especially pigs, and took them to the waterfront to be delivered to the river ports of Louisville and Cincinnati. There the meat was salt-cured and shipped throughout the settled parts of North America. Like the salt from the brine springs of Salis de Berne, Kanawha salt was highly soluble and fast-penetrating, ideally suited for curing meat. The city of Cincinnati was built into a major commercial center with salt from Kanawha and pigs from Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. By the late 1830s, Cincinnati was packing almost one-third of all Western American hogs, more than 100,000 hogs per year. Other centers on the Ohio, such as Louisville, Kentucky, and Madison, Indiana, also prospered. Kanawha served this Midwestern market with little competition. Unlike the French and the Spanish, English settlers and their American descendants tended to bring salt with them rather than find it where they went. In a market-driven society, a distant but efficient salt works with good transportation seemed a more practical solution than a nearby but inefficient salt works. As Americans moved west, they shipped salt from the east, just as the settlers in the east had shipped it from England. Indiana, Illinois, and Kentucky salt works, many of them adapted by the French from the salt works of indigenous people, had weaker brine than Kanawha and used wood rather than coal. This made Kanawha salt far cheaper to produce. In fact, even at outrageously inflated prices, Kanawha salt makers could still undersell their competitors, not only because of the density of their brine, but because their workers were slaves. Kanawha was in the state of Virginia, which had a huge slave-based tobacco industry that was slowly declining. The large tobacco plantations had more slaves than they could use, and the owners saw an economic opportunity in renting these people to Kanawha salt producers. According to the 1810 census, Kanawha County had 352 slaves, but by 1850, 3,140 slaves lived in the county, mostly assigned to salt works. By law, the salt works could only require slaves to work 6 days a week, but this law was seldom enforced. The best job for a slave at the salt works was barrel maker. The salt was shipped in barrels, and slaves were expected to make 7 barrels a day. Sometimes owners who rented their slaves would negotiate better terms, such as only 6 barrels being required a day. The worst job in the salt works, and one almost exclusively done by slaves, was coal mining. Slave owners would sometimes stipulate that their slaves were not to be used as coal miners, arguing that it was a misuse of their valuable property. Coal miners were often maimed or killed in cave-ins. The salt works themselves were also dangerous, especially for slaves who were not trained in this industry. Boilers exploded, and sometimes workers would slip into near-boiling pots of brine. The owners sometimes sued the salt makers to be compensated for the loss or damage of their human property. Plantation slaves did not want to be leased to salt works, and they would sometimes escape while being taken west. The slaves knew that, like the salt, they were only a short journey to Ohio, which was a free state. Many slaves escaped by land or water, and salt makers would hire men to go to Ohio and bring them back. Once steamboats appeared, runaways increased, in part because of the transportation the boats afforded, and in part because the boats hired free blacks who would encourage escape. Even the slaves who worked on the boats clearly lived a better life than the slaves in Kanawha. In January 1835, Judge Lewis Summers complained, "There seems to be some restlessness among the slaves of the salt works, and I thought more uneasiness in relation to that species of property than usual." Robert Fulton did not invent the steamboat, though he did build one of the first submarines, the Nautilus, which the French, British, and American governments all rejected. Fulton's enduring fame comes from a steamboat he launched in New York Harbor in 1807 that sailed the Hudson. Numerous earlier steamboats had been built, and in 1790, John Fitch had established the first steamboat service, ferrying passengers between Philadelphia and Trenton. But such experiments were all commercial failures. Robert Fulton's Hudson River boat made money and demonstrated for the first time the commercial viability of steam-powered, flat-bottom, paddle-wheel-propelled riverboats. These boats created Kanawha's first real competition. By the 1820s, steamboats for the first time made Liverpool salt accessible in the U.S. interior because they had enough power to carry a heavy salt load upriver against the strong currents of western waterways. The British liked to carry salt as ballast for their cotton trade with New Orleans, and they landed Liverpool, Turks, and Salt Keys salt there. The new steamboats carried foreign salt up the Mississippi River system, including the Ohio. The shallow-hulled steamboats could even navigate past the falls of the Ohio at Louisville, which had previously excluded Madison and Cincinnati from Mississippi traffic. While this was happening, the Erie Canal opened, providing Syracuse with a western waterway. Before the Erie Canal, Onondaga salt had to be carried by pack mule to Lake Erie. The New York salt was preferred by many because, as with French Bay salt, the slow solar evaporation process produced a desirable coarse grain. But because of slavery and ample nearby coal fields for fuel, Kanawha salt was cheaper. No sooner was the Erie Canal opened than other canal projects were proposed. The first one was started in 1832, a 334-mile artificial waterway called the Trans-Ohio Canal, from the Ohio River to Cleveland on Lake Erie. Salt was the only bulk commodity transported on the Trans-Ohio Canal. By 1845, canals also connected Onondaga salt to the Wabash in Indiana. The Erie Canal offered a refund on tolls to New York State salt producers if they used the canal to carry salt out of state. In trade on the Great Lakes, salt became ballast where empty ships had previously been weighted with sand. Sometimes they would carry the salt for free. By the 1840s, Syracuse, not Kanawha, became the leading supplier of salt in the Midwest. In the 1840s, the Kanawha salt makers received another blow. The protective tariffs against imported salt designed to stimulate domestic salt production after the Revolution were angering Westerners because they raised the price of salt. In their view, by taxing imported salt, the government was allowing domestic producers to overcharge. Kanawha, in particular, was the salt producer singled out for this accusation. In 1840, Missouri Senator Thomas Hart Benton delivered a speech in the U.S. Senate comparing Kanawha salt makers to the British East India Company, a despised instrument of British colonialism, the economic system that Americans had fought two wars against. The tax on foreign salt, by tending to diminish its importation, and by throwing what was imported at its only seaport, New Orleans, into the hands of regraters, this tax was the parent and handmaiden of a monopoly of salt, which, for the extent of territory over which it operated, the number of people whom it oppressed, and the variety and enormity of its oppressions, had no parallel on earth, except among the Hindus in Eastern Asia, under the iron despotism of the British East India Company. The American monopolizers operate by the moneyed power, and with the aid of banks. They borrow money and rent the salt wells to lie idle. They pay owners of the wells not to work them. They pay other owners not to open new wells. Thus, among us, they suppress the production by preventing the manufacture of salt. Thomas Hart Benton, U.S. Senate, April 22, 1840. Among the opponents of Senator Benton in the Senate was the delegation from Massachusetts, which desperately wanted to preserve the tariffs. But by the end of the decade, the tariffs were removed, and not only Kanawha, but also Cape Cod could no longer compete. By 1849, when Henry David Thoreau visited the Cape, he was already writing about salt works being broken up and sold for lumber. Those boards, used to build storage sheds, were still leaching salt crystals 100 years later. By then, the Cape Cod salt industry was long vanished. Kanawha survived. Soon the country would be divided into north and south, and it would become apparent that a southern salt works was an important and all too rare asset. Chapter 16. The War Between the Salts. In the 1939 classic film of the Civil War, Gone with the Wind, Rhett Butler sneered at Southern boasts of imminent victory, pointing out that not a single cannon was made in the entire South. But the lack of an arms industry was not the only strategic shortcoming of the South. It also did not make enough salt. In 1858, the principal salt states of the South, Virginia, Kentucky, Florida, and Texas, produced 2,365,000 bushels of salt, while New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania produced 12 million bushels. By 1860, the United States had become a huge salt consumer, Americans using far more salt per capita than Europeans. Numerous salt works had sprung up in the North. Onondaga, the leading salt supplier, reached its peak production during the Civil War. The 200 acres of vats in 1829 had expanded to 6,000 acres by 1862, when it employed 3,000 workers and produced more than 9 million bushels of salt. The United States as a whole was still dependent on foreign salt, but most of those imports went to the South. The imports from England and the British Caribbean were landed in the port of New Orleans. 1/4 of all English salt entering the United States came through New Orleans. From 1857 to 1860, 350 tons of British salt were unloaded in New Orleans every day, ballast for the cotton trade. As generals from George Washington to Napoleon discovered, war without salt is a desperate situation.